From Texas to Nevada, Oregon to Kentucky, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the number of new federal regulations skyrocketed during the Biden administration. But has the tide turned? Wayne Cruz from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here with the answer. Elon Musk is cutting back on his time with the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a real story. After years of delay, Real ID is about to go into effect. But is it a good idea? Eric Boehm and Emma Camp of Reason Magazine discuss. And the American Civil Liberties Union is once again showing its bias against the Christian religion. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Biden administration greatly expanded the number of federal regulations, but the Trump administration is working to turn the tide. Wayne Cruz is the Fred L. Smith Fellow in Regulatory Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he is author of the annual 10,000 Commandments Report. He is here to discuss. Wayne, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Wayne, the annual 10,000 Commandments Report is out. So that our listeners know what we are talking about, tell us a bit about the report, its history. What is it meant to reveal?
Well, the 10,000 Commandments Report, believe it or not, I've been doing this thing now for 32 years. It's a way of trying to capture the extent of the hidden tax of federal regulation. This year, for example, we know the federal government is going to spend $7 trillion with a T. And we know at the same time that the deficit is going to be about $2 trillion. What I try to do with 10,000 Commandments, if you think of the federal budget and its historical tables, the effort with this is to come up with a snapshot every year that gives the public a way of looking up the scope of the regulatory state. Now, that's all the things that the federal government does in environmental regulation, economic regulation, health and safety, antitrust, medical regulation, all of these ways that the federal government, apart from its spending, puts or imposes compliance costs on the economy. So what I also do is I include numbers of rules and their effects to the extent we can. Just to put that in perspective, last year, the Congress passed about 175 laws. But at the same time, the federal agencies issued over 3,200 rules and regulations. And so sometimes I joke and call that the unconstitutionality index. You know, there are 19 rules from unelected regulators for every law that Congress passes. And so that's one way of looking at it. Another, in addition to cost, which I peg the cost at $2 trillion, well, $2.155 trillion is what I'm using, based on OMB's figures and legacy figures from the federal government, private estimates, and things like that. But that $2 trillion I just mentioned, that's equivalent to this year's deficit. It's also roughly equivalent to what the individual income tax is. It's four times corporate income taxes, and that $2 trillion is about 60% of corporate pre-tax profits, which are about $3.5 trillion. So regulation is huge. Another way of looking at it, in addition to all those rules, is Federal Register pages. And last year, that exploded to cosmic levels. Under Biden, in his last year, the Federal Register was over 105,000 pages. And that's the daily depository of rules and regulations that come out each year. The Trump administration managed to get that down in its first term into the 60s. We'll see what happens this time, because, you know, part of what we're tracking in 10,000 Commandments is we see the numbers of rules that are coming out from different administrations, and it gives us an opportunity to compare things like numbers of pages, numbers of rules, costs they might have added, numbers of significant rules, and things like that. And with the arrival of Trump, a lot of that has been cut back.
So we see the Trump administration starting to cut back on a lot of the regulatory overreach from the Biden administration here. One of the reforms that you have been advocating is a regulatory reduction commission. What would you envision that commission doing?
A long time ago, back in the days when I was much younger, still had hair and worked on Capitol Hill, there was this notion that had just been done and performed of a military base closure commission. And other members of Congress and members of the Senate had the idea of a debt reduction commission back at that time. And I worked for Phil Graham at the time, and he had the Texas senator, former Texas senator, and he had the notion of a regulatory reduction commission where it would be bipartisan. Every year they would assemble a package of rules for up or down vote to eliminate. And it would be something that there'd be bipartisan agreement on it. It would go to the president. There are a whole lot of other reforms in play now. You might remember in the first Trump administration, he had a one-in, two-out mechanism for treating regulations and dealing with the flow. The Biden administration came in and eliminated that and all of the Trump streamlining. There were other measures that Trump had taken back then, like regulatory task forces as the agencies, to kind of do what a commission would do, to look at the flow and decide what might be useful to eliminate. Well, Biden had a modernizing regulatory review, and he basically did away with review at that time. When Trump came back in, he really amped up his prior program. And speaking of this regulatory reduction commission, you know we now have the DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. Part of what it's doing is looking at each agency now has what they call a DOGE team lead. And so they're putting together packages of rules and putting together rules and prioritizing them for elimination when the upcoming unified agenda comes out. Twice a year, the agencies put their priorities out in a unified agenda. Well, this time, instead of like under the Biden administration, where those priorities are adding new regulations, under Trump, they're eliminating them. So in a way, we're getting like an executive branch version of a regulatory reduction commission. But there are also Trump directives now that are putting in place sunset clauses for rules, which kind of automates that process, right? If you know, rather than doing a commission, each rule that gets issued now just has a sunset date on it. And the only way it continues is if the agency gets up on its hind legs and re-justifies the rule after a period of years. So some interesting streamlining measures like that are underway. The commission is one of them, but also, you know, having Congress vote to approve the most significant of rules and regulations that come out of the pipeline every year would be another way of restoring congressional responsibility. Because remember, Congress is supposed to be the one making the laws, not unelected agencies. And what they would do with, it's called the RAINS Act, stands for Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny. They always have these strange acronyms, but it would have Congress approve the most burdensome of rules, and I think it also should encompass the ones that are the most controversial as well, in addition to the ones that are simply the most burdensome. So that's important. If we end up finding, Loman, that we can't do a reduction commission and OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, is reluctant to perform reviews of regulation post-Trump. I think during the Trump administration, they're going to be quite aggressive. But we can restore power to Congress. You know, Congress may be able to have a regulatory review commission that supersedes what OMB does. So things like that are interesting. Sunsetting a reg commission, having Congress approve rules, a regulatory cost budget. At the very least, we need better transparency. Because if you look at it on the budgetary side, we know what the federal government spends and what the debt is. And we know that the debt is approaching $40 trillion now. You may hate it, may drive you nuts, but you can at least look it up. The same is not true with regulations. And that's sort of what I'm hoping to achieve with 10,000 commandments. And to a degree we have, in the sense that you can look up the historical tables for federal spending. Each year's edition of my annual report kind of puts together like a historical tables of the regulatory state. So that's my goal, to shine a light on it and then see if Congress will ultimately do something about it. But it really comes down to Congress assuming responsibility for all these rules and not overpower, which it loves to do, because it can take credit for some new program. But if the rules drive and the red tape drive people crazy, it can just say, hey, those agencies are out of control, not our fault.
Well, the report is 10,000 Commandments. Its author, Wayne Cruz, at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Fred, tell us a little bit about CEI. Also, if folks want to read 10,000 Commandments, where can they find it?
All you have to do is go to CEI.org, very simple. And CEI was founded in George Orwell's year, 1984, by Fred L. Smith, Jr., and he's our founder, and he was our light. And he is the one who my fellowship is named for Fred. And Fred had the notion that, you know, business has a role to play in advancing capitalism. There needed to be a group in Washington that focused on the regulatory state, because you had entities and think tanks working on taxes and budget and welfare and war and things like that. But none so much at the time focused on the regulatory enterprise. And that's where CEI came in.
Wayne Cruz of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Wayne, thank you for being with us.
It has been absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for thinking of us. Thank you so much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Some major developments in the economy, some major developments in Washington, D.C., and the first 100 days of the Trump administration. Scott, good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be back, Lemon. Thank you.
This past week, gross domestic product, GDP numbers came out, a small contraction, about 0.3%, but Democrats are making a lot of hay out of that. There are reasons behind that, though, so your thoughts on that?
First of all, I think it's worth pointing out that the way GDP is calculated is sort of flawed in itself, right? Government spending, federal spending, ballooned underneath the Democrats and the Biden administration, how much extra money that they pumped into the economy. And you have folks like Elon Musk and the Doge Commission that are working to reduce federal spending and ways through the executive branch without legislative action that they can get done. And that's reduced about $180 billion. And, you know, when you think about 0.3% of GDP in a contraction, it also reminds me that in the Biden term, we had two consecutive quarters of contractions, and the media was so giddy to try to cover for him that they redefined what a recession was. But nonetheless, I think that the data that was out this week is a good reason for us to push in the right direction for growth and really the policies that are going to get the economy headed in the right direction.
Speaking of Elon Musk, his time as head of Doge is winding down a bit, and that was pre-planned from the very beginning. So what impact is his stepping back from that going to have here, Scott?
Yeah, well, Elon Musk has been what's termed as a special government employee. And so it's basically a temporary worker that has expertise to get things up and running at the beginning of the administration, but wasn't subject to the same disclosure laws that you would see for like a personal financial disclosure that most federal employees need to submit. And Elon appeared at the cabinet meeting this week. President Trump and the rest of the cabinet really gave him their thanks through a pretty resounding applause. And Elon Musk has obviously been working 6-7 days a week. He, you know, has talked about the late nights, and I guess President Trump has even allowed him to, on occasion, sleep in the Lincoln bedroom. And listen, he's going to be dialing it back. He says now he will continue to serve with President Trump as long as Trump would like his help and advice. But he's going to go back to his businesses and really be working about 1 to 3 days every 2 weeks. He says he'll come to the White House every other week and continue to make sure that the process and the experts that he put in place with Doge are plowing forward and really finding these efficiencies that are necessary for us to have a government that just isn't wasting so much money and becoming bloated and unaccountable.
We also, this past week, Scott, hit a very important milestone, the first 100 days of the second Trump administration. Back when Franklin Roosevelt was first elected president, he had a very active first 100 days, although he had massive Democrat majorities in the Congress to help him out. President Trump has not had that luxury, but it appears that the president has really turned the ship around in many ways here in that brief period of time. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I certainly think so. You know, it's obviously, in using his coined term, it's the new golden age, and it's a real chance for us to sort of recover our freedoms and, you know, end all the tyranny that was happening underneath the Biden administration. And really, you know, the folks that were working for Biden that didn't tell him exactly what they were doing. You know, you even heard from Marco Rubio this week that there were dossiers on members of Trump's cabinet with social media posts. And, you know, just the way that the State Department of all places, not the FBI, not the CIA, but the State Department was collecting information on American citizens. You know, I think the first 100 days have obviously gone super fast. It's, you know, there's been progress forward in like the reconciliation bill, for example. That's something that I would have loved to have had done by May 1st. But there are real challenges with the Senate and the House majorities being so small. You know, the good thing is that like President Trump got his cabinet confirmed faster than Joe Biden did. And that's a testament to John Thune and all the Senate Republicans for the work that they did to really get those folks in positions where they can work with Trump on the executive actions that he's giving the American people through the executive branch. And then obviously we want to try to make those things permanent when possible through the Congress. You know, the next 100 days, I think, are what are really going to be defining for President Trump and really the first year of his administration. I think over the next 100 days, we're going to get those tax cuts extended, additional money going to the border. We're also going to see reforms that continue to drive down the prices of, you know, gasoline and food.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. Our members, 525,000 plus, are united in the idea of economic freedom. You can visit us at clubforgrowth.org and actually sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
If you plan on boarding a plane or entering a federal government building, you are going to need a real ID. Eric Boehm and Emma Camp of Reason Magazine report on the much-delayed implementation.
So if you've been to an airport any time in like the last 20 years, it feels like you've probably seen the signs that you have to get a real ID. And there's always a deadline attached to this. And it always seems like that deadline is like 6 months away. And it seems like it never actually arrives. But it maybe has actually arrived. It's possible that this month, May 2025, is the actual deadline to get a real ID. So what is a real ID? And is that deadline actually here, finally, after 20-some years? Those are the questions we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Emma Camp. She's a colleague of mine at Reason, an associate editor for Reason Magazine, and she's written a piece that asks the question I want to ask Emma, which is real ID actually happening? So thank you for taking some time and joining us here on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's ask the big question. Is real ID actually happening?
Probably. The thing is, so real ID was originally passed in 2005. It was part of this big suite of sort of post 9/11 national security laws. The idea was because some 9/11 hijackers used forged documents to get on the plane, let's make everybody have a more secure, you know, more rigorous form of ID to get on a plane. And that law, enforcement of that law has been delayed 7 times. You know, 2005 was a long time ago. That was 20 years ago. And so I think it's probably actually going to happen because the last time it was delayed from May 2023 to May 7th, 2025. And we're getting really close to that deadline and we haven't heard any rumblings about delaying it. Normally when they delay it months out. But also because of how frequent these delays have been, I don't want to rule out an 11th hour pushback. And also, frankly, because the Trump administration, on the one hand, has been very stringent on immigration rules. And a lot of this, too, is you have to prove your legal status. So there's like there's sort of a national security immigration element of it that the Trump administration might support. But at the same time, they've been a little chaotic, to say the least, in the way that they've been enforcing their policies. So on the one hand, I think it's I give it like 75% odds that it's actually going to happen. But also we could wake up tomorrow and, you know, Elon Musk is going, no, we're not doing real ID. You know, we're going to delay it another 2 years.
Yeah, we are recording this just afternoon on May 1st. And so everything is accurate as of this moment. By the time you're hearing this, it might be May 3rd or May 4th. And who knows? Things may have changed.
I wrote an article actually like 2 years ago, basically saying, yeah, it's probably not ever going to happen.
So you'll be right either way. Either it's happening or it's not. Let's actually back up a little bit here for people that maybe aren't aware of this or maybe still have questions about it. What makes a real ID different from your old school driver's license?
So it basically requires you to prove your identity in a couple more ways. So for example, you're often required to provide proof of your social security number, extra proofs of address, that kind of thing. That just goes a couple steps more than what you're required to do to get a driver's license. And then the ID that you have will have a physical star on it. The irony, of course, is that this law was basically passed to deter fraudulent documents. It's just a star. So really, all it will do is tell forgers that they need to put clip art of a little black star on the IDs that they're making.
We're talking with Emma Kemp. She's an associate editor at Reason Magazine, talking about the Real ID deadline that is rapidly approaching here, possibly approaching as soon as next week. Emma, one of the reasons why this has been postponed so many times has to do with compliance, has to do with getting states and getting residents of states to go along with getting these new IDs that the federal government wants everybody to have. That's still a concern, even as this deadline approaches now, some 20 years after we passed this law.
Yeah, for sure. So all 50 states were not even giving out real ID compliant IDs until 2020, so 15 years after the law was passed. And one of the main reasons behind this is that a lot of states were really hesitant to comply with real ID because it essentially creates a national database of ID holders. You know, the law, like supporters of the law will say, no, it doesn't create a national database. But what it does do is it creates 50 state databases that talk to each other. So it essentially creates a national database of ID holders that creates a lot of privacy concerns. And right now, there are many, many states with less than even 50% compliance. New Jersey only has 17% compliance. And what this means is that it will make domestic air travel really challenging, if not impossible, for millions of Americans who don't have these real ID compliant IDs. You can use a passport in lieu of a real ID. So a lot of people, if you have it, but also a lot of Americans don't have passports, right? And so in my view, it's sort of unnecessarily making it difficult for people to travel.
It also makes me wonder, like, okay, we passed this law in the wake of 9/11. We did a lot of things in the wake of 9/11 that maybe we shouldn't have done, but we haven't required real ID for 20 years and there hasn't been another.
Right, exactly. The whole justification behind the law, which is we need to do this to prevent terrorism, over the past 20 years has shown itself to be unnecessary. Since 9/11, we haven't had another terrorist attack. And even if there was somebody planning a similar attack, this law would not actually stop them because it doesn't actually make forging that much more difficult.
All right, there's a lot of privacy concerns about the law. And yeah, I think I agree with you, Emma. There just doesn't seem to be a lot of reason for going through with this. But it looks like we are finally going to go through with it. If you don't have a real ID and you're planning to travel by air sometime in the next few months, this may be a problem for you. You may want to look into it. We are unfortunately out of time for today. Emma, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And once again, that's Emma Kemp. She's an associate editor at Reason Magazine, a colleague of mine there at Reason. Check out her piece with all the information on this. Is Real ID actually happening? That's the headline on it. You can find that this week at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Once again, the American Civil Liberties Union has revealed its bias and ignorance of the Christian religion and its customs. So says Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The American Civil Liberties Union gets defensive when accused of being hostile to the concerns and freedoms of Christians. But there is no denying the troubling track record, and everyone knows it. A conservative Jewish friend of mine calls the ACLU the Anti-Christian Liberties Union. I've actually written about that history in books, with special attention to ACLU founders Roger Baldwin and Harry Ward, and early board members Clarence Darrow and William Z. Foster. Foster was actually the head of Communist Party USA and a militant atheist. No one, however, has written about the ACLU like Bill Donahue of the Venerable Catholic League. Donahue has done books, articles, press releases, and even did his dissertation on the ACLU, for which he interviewed Roger Baldwin himself. His Catholic League has long monitored the group, and Donahue says of the ACLU, quote, "I am convinced that most of its board members and senior officials harbor a deep animus against religion. Nothing bothers them more than Christianity, especially Catholicism," unquote. Currently, Bill Donahue is calling attention to a crazy ACLU case, and it's yet another example that makes Christians believe that the ACLU is indeed hostile to their faith. Here it is. The ACLU of Massachusetts is challenging a decision by the city of Quincy to erect two statues of Catholic saints outside the public safety building. The saints are Florian and Michael the Archangel, the patron saints of firefighters and police officers, respectively. As Bill Donahue notes, the ACLU knows that religious statues adorn buildings in the nation's capital, including the Capitol building, Supreme Court, Library of Congress, as well as public buildings throughout the state of Massachusetts. So why object to these statues? Well, the ACLU explains in a letter to the Quincy City Council. It states, quote, are you ready for this? "The contemplated statue of St. Michael depicts a figure stepping on the neck of a demon. Such violent imagery is particularly abhorrent in light of the murder of George Floyd and other acts of police brutality throughout the country," unquote. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you heard that right. The Massachusetts ACLU is complaining that a statue depicting Michael the Archangel stepping on the neck of a demon, which, to be sure, is represented in all Catholic religious imagery of Michael the Archangel, evokes the image of George Floyd being stepped on the neck by a police officer. Bill Donahue responds to this by asking, is the ACLU crazy? Indeed. But there's more at work here. It's ideology and ignorance. The Massachusetts ACLU is ignorant of basic religious facts. And the facts are these. There's a famous St. Michael the Archangel prayer composed in the 19th century by Pope Leo XIII. It's recited at the end of Mass in many Catholic parishes. It implores the saint to, quote, "defend us in battle and be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil." It urges the archangel to, quote, "cast into hell Satan and all the evil spirits who prowl about the world seeking the ruin of souls." That long-time prayer, ladies and gentlemen, has nothing to do with George Floyd. And yet, in our secular age, so many people, like the people at the ACLU, lack such basic religious knowledge. Here are some other examples. Last year, liberals on social media blasted what they called traditional conservative Catholics for describing the Rosary and Virgin Mary as a weapon against evil. But Catholics have long believed that. In fact, Mary herself is often depicted as stepping on the neck of the serpent, i.e. the devil. Her spouse, St. Joseph, is known as Terror of Demons. This should tell the ACLU something, namely, it's unwise to stack your organization with people who are ignorant of the very religions that they're dealing with. The ignorance comes off as hostility. And look, ACLU, if you don't want to appear that way, then create a DEI program for your own staff. Include diverse people with different beliefs. And if you refuse to do that, then don't complain when others interpret your ignorance as hostility toward their religion. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WEEM-FM in Pendleton, Indiana, KMWV-FM in Salem, Oregon, along with KSAK-FM in Walnut, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.